This week, all three major U.S. equities indexes touched record highs, with the Dow once again at a 100-year record. Welcome back, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, back with you with another two big guest interviews. Martin Armstrong of Armstrong Economics thinks the equities bull market might have much further to go. He's looking for 25,000 Dow, perhaps even much higher. He's also watching the ECB still, convinced it will be the first central bank to shut its doors. A major central bank might go bankrupt as plans to consolidate all the toxic debt in the EU into collateralized debt obligations might backfire. Then Nick Barashev of Bullion Management Group, author of $10,000 Gold, tells us just why 10,000 might be a conservative figure for the yellow metal. He notes security issues and very low investments in the precious metals, the safe haven of choice in pension funds, institutions, and even individual portfolios, as a major reason why everyone needs to increase their allocation to gold and silver. Plus, the World Gold Council announced that gold production has peaked. Mines can no longer produce enough output to increase supply. It has been over a week since Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, causing unprecedented destruction and a humanitarian crisis. It's looking as though it's really just the beginning of the crisis. Death toll, sadly, of 18 expected to climb, especially with the sick, elderly, and young who have very little resources available. In fact, almost every one of the 1.5 million electricity customers in the nation are without power still. On a positive note, the campaign to have a U.S. Navy hospital ship did succeed. A 1,000-bed Navy ship with trauma unit and X-ray machines is either en route or in port now at Puerto Rico. So hat tip to the U.S. Navy. Anchors away. And on another tragic note, we've lost a huge contributor to GoldSeek. Julian D.W. Phillips of the Gold Forecaster passed away less than a month ago, and I apologize for being a bit late in mentioning this tragic event here. One of our colleagues and will be missed. His analysis was regularly available at Market Watch, and of course he and Peter put together the Gold Forecaster. So if you'd like to read Peter's comments on the passing, you can find that at GoldSeek. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Mostly cloudy skies persisted for the third week over the precious metals sector. Gold fell 12, falling just to 1284, while silver dropped 31 cents, ending at 1670. Both metals are considerably higher, though, for the year still. Precious metals XAU dropped 1.4 points, finding good solid support at the 200-period moving average, ending at 84.65. Black gold, though, bucked the trend up a dollar in a big winning streak here week after week, up 2% at 51.67. We believe a big part of that is solid global demand led by the U.S., China, and other developing nations, and of course ongoing talks with the OPEC nations and Russia regarding cuts. Plus, we have to remember the tragic Hurricane Harvey, which decimated Houston and the region there, where there's an awful lot of oil rigs and our key refineries in the Gulf. Meanwhile, the top story impacting the gold market, strong dollar, which although was rallied sharply, it did meet big resistance at its 200-period moving average in the weekly chart. The greenback climbed sharply on increased rate hike odds at the upcoming December meeting, not November, but December. The FOMC will meet again, and the Fed funds futures have climbed sharply, almost by 50% higher than just a month ago, to a 76% probability, nearly a lock that we'll get another quarter point increase. Moving on to the domestic economic situation, consumer spending climbed 0.1% last month, which met expectations. However, spending did decline for the first time in almost 1 year. Personal income climbed 0.2%, and the Fed's inflation gauge increased 0.1% last month. Precious metals bottom line. Well, the CRB and West Texas crude continued to build solid head and shoulders patterns. In fact, I would argue that oil has already broken out, and the CRB economy may be on the cusp of a breakout, and still silver and gold look like they're carving out very positive patterns as well. Better things ahead for the precious metals. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility virtually unlimited yet again as the Dow Jones climbed higher 55 points, closing at a new all-time record, 22,405. The S&P also at a new record, adding 17 points at 2520 for the first time since trading began, and the NASDAQ picked up 69 at 6495, also a new weekly and all-time high. The Bitcoin ETF settled higher about 40 points, ending at 702. We believe that there's likely going to be a continued correction, taking Bitcoin down to around 25 to 2600 before setting the stage for the next big rally to 5000 and beyond. In related news, U.S. large cap stocks were outperformed by their smaller brethren, the small caps, picked up nearly 3% on talks of tax reform in Congress this Wednesday. But as one might expect, it was energy stocks that stole the show. They've gained anywhere from 10 to 20% over the last 30 days after remaining the worst performing sector for most of this year, with oil over 50 now, levels we haven't seen in some time. Bottom line on U.S. equities. Well, our 7 indicator greed to fear index remains at extremely frothy levels now. All 3 major indices did record higher highs and lows. After testing support, they closed at new highs, and this is just a classic sign of a steady bull market. I wouldn't be surprised at all to see higher highs in the coming weeks and months ahead. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek. Pleasure to welcome Nick Barishev back to the show, CEO of Bullion Management Group and author of $10,000 Gold, Why Gold's Inevitable Rise is the Investor's Safe Haven. I have 2 hard copies here, published, I think, in 2013. It's hard to believe it's been that long. Welcome back, Nick Barishev.
Thing is, when the book came out, I was like a lone wolf in the wilderness talking about $10,000 gold. Now, got all kinds of people, including Jim Rickards. He's talking anywhere from 10 to 50,000. You know, a lot of other people are talking the same kind of numbers, and they obviously in terms of the possibility of a major reset in the pricing and so on, something that's becoming more mainstream and doesn't seem to be kind of a way out there theory or anything like that.
Firstly, we're very excited to have you on the show today, as well as you mentioned Jim Rickards. We have a scheduled October interview, his debut here on the show. It's interesting that he's calling for this sort of freeze of the monetary system. And maybe that's a good segue into one of the topics we were discussing before the show, the idea of Bitcoin and cryptos as digital money. We believe that it's just a natural evolution of fiat money.
It could be like, for instance, China intends to use the blockchain to create its own fiat money. So that's a possibility. But private cryptocurrencies, I studied that at length. There's been all kinds. And then what eventually happens, because the initial attraction is the anonymity of using them, but then what happens is the money launderers, drug dealers, and pornographers start using them. And whether you get set up with one of those or they're real guys, then, you know, the boys come down and shut down the operation, and if they can find anybody to arrest, they will. Look at what happened to the Liberty Dollar. That was an actual silver dollar. The second thing, you know, whether it's fiat currency or cryptocurrencies, and we're all becoming too complacent with the security of the computer systems. Like a couple of years ago in Australia, half the banks used a certain software for the banking systems, and there was a glitch developed in that. During a 2-week period, you were locked out of your bank account, your credit cards, your debit cards, anything. So even for a space of 2 weeks, unless you had physical currency, you had a real problem for 2 weeks. And the latest thing, this hacking at Equifax, just goes to show, so to have my wealth or, you know, my money in a digital system where I don't own anything but computer digits, that it's replaced with the SDR, which to some extent can be looked at as an improvement over a single reserve currency like the U.S. dollar, that you've got a basket of currency. So that's okay for the short term, but where that leads us to is a one world currency.
Yeah, and you brought up the interesting development there in China, of course, with Iran and several of their trading partners essentially rejecting the greenback in favor of a gold and oil-backed currency.
Well, China can pull it off because that's what happened to Saddam Hussein, was going to price oil in euros, and then Omar Gaddafi was going to create an African, gold currency. So we saw what happened. That's the issue where it's critical for the U.S. to maintain its reserve status and to price primarily oil. Tried to move off the U.S. dollar. Now what you've got is a giant mess of a failed state. They were better off with the dictators, the people. So that's the thing. So now we have China, and to a certain extent with Russia's cooperation and some of the other countries. So they set up an exchange where they're pricing oil in yuan. Now yuan, got enough confidence to sell your oil in yuan, but they've now set it up so that the yuan is convertible to gold. So that's a whole new ballgame. And the real risk is that if Saudi Arabia moves to price Saudi oil in different currencies, then the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency has a big, big problem.
Oh, we agree with you. We think that the reserve currency will never likely eclipse the recent peak that we saw in the last couple of years. We see a confluence of negative factors, including the cryptos. The entire fiat currency system will be overturned. You and I discussed this a bit, that China is the first country to develop an institute solely for the study of cryptocurrencies. So they're obviously interested and have made some public comments, both China and Russia, in a national blockchain currency. How might that impact your theories?
Blockchain as a technology could be considered an improvement on fiat currencies, but the problem is the governments aren't going to allow private cryptocurrencies. Like, once they get successful enough one way or another, they'll be shut down. I mean, they've got a monopoly to do fiat currencies. You're not going to have competition for that monopoly.
Of course, we agree with you here. The precious metals are the most solid currency. But there is, I think, an interesting argument in the pro column, if you will, for cryptos. You might even say it's a refutation of the negative factors. We hear a lot about how nefarious practices are turning to the crypto space, but I could make the argument that the typical big city ATM machine supplies more currency for negative transactions than the cryptos.
That, of course, is what they're trying to, moving toward elimination of cash so that they solve that problem. That's a serious concern if they get to pull that off, but that's the intended direction.
Let's move on now, if we could, to your $10,000 gold. Seeing good signs of that in 2017, positive technicals in the precious metals shares, as well as silver, gold, platinum, palladium.
When you look at it in terms of this year to date, gold's one of the best performing asset classes, like outperforming the equities and so on. So we're already there. But the real risk now is that we've got this triple bubble. From my recollection, that's not happened in my career. The only time that we could be anywhere close to that is 1929. But so we've got a real estate bubble. I've basically been in the real estate business most of my life, and I've never seen a bubble so absurd as it has been, over the last couple of years. Then, followed by bonds, which, unless we go to negative interest rates, have got nowhere to go but down once the interest rates correct, and the stock markets are reaching 1929 bubble valuations. To compound the problem, we've got a mountain of debt and derivatives that all this is sitting on top of. So when we look at the Fed's balance sheet and the S&P 500, it's almost a perfect correlation. The reason the S&P has gone up, not because of improved earnings or outlooks, is because the Fed has thrown a lot of money into the system, and when it didn't show up in inflation, but it showed up in, asset appreciation. So the thing is, if we look at previous bubbles, like 1999 was an equity bubble, primarily in NASDAQ stocks, and then 2007, 2008 was a real estate bubble. But there's never been one where we've got like a simultaneous bubble. And if any one of those three pops, it'll take the other two down with it. And people are complacent because there comes a time like when you shouldn't be invested, because your upside is relatively minimal compared to your downside. If you take a 50% hit, you need 100% to recover. And if you're a baby boomer,
exactly,
facing that, like if you go to 1999, the FANG stock, so to speak, at the time, were Cisco, IBM, Intel, Microsoft, and Oracle. Now, if you happen to be invested in them in 1999, you broke even with IBM in 2007, so that took you 7 years. You broke even in Microsoft in August 2016, and Oracle you broke even in 2017, and the others you haven't even broken even yet. So that's the FANG stocks of 1999. Now, the companies were good companies. There's earnings, growth, profit, growth, everything. They're all still around and doing well. But the stock price was absurd in 1999. And we've got the same sort of thing in today's FANG stocks. Amazon's a good company, you know, Netflix, etc. They're all good companies that will probably do well. But you as an investor won't do well if you're invested when they correct. People don't think about it, is there's times to not be invested for the little bit of hanging in there for that minuscule upside that might happen from here on in. You're risking a 50 to a 70% hit.
Yeah, you'll recall what Edwin Lefebvre wrote, that the most expensive ticks in the market were the top and the bottom ticks, because folks, they chase those 2 points so much.
They think, well, if the market corrects, I'll see the top and then I'll get out. But oftentimes the market corrects like quickly and you have a 10% hit, and then people say, well, you know, I'll wait till that corrects and then I'll get out. And instead of correcting to the upside, it takes another 20% down. So then they say, well, I've got a 30% loss, so I don't want to sell now. But, you know, there'll soon be a correction, and they keep waiting that out until they're like 50 to 70% down. You know, and that's how it, you know, typically goes. But it's a very dangerous time to be in. It's unprecedented.
I'd like to maybe focus on this idea you bring up, this trifecta of bubbles. And I think we could probably make a case for several other bubbles, but important key multi-decade bubbles. Okay. This is not just a flash in the pan, you know, stocks which supposedly corrected during the 2000s, but it was just a plateau, if you will, for this exponential move. And then you bring up bonds and you bring up real estate. And Dr. Robert Shiller at Yale just corroborated your thoughts that he just cannot believe what this echo bubble in real estate and the S&P. So he's backing up your thoughts there.
This market is completely unaffordable by the population there. There's like an income to debt ratio and price ratio, and those are all way offline that can't be handled.
Wouldn't you agree the bulk of investors and retirees and pensioners have parked their hard-earned wealth? If those three safe havens fail, what are the implications?
Well, the trouble is that most investors have a double whammy, because when those three fail, not if they fail, the pension funds that are already failing, I mean, the pension funds are failing when we had a bull market. What's going to happen when we have a bear market? Your savings get decimated, your real estate gets decimated, and you get a letter from the pension company that, sorry, we're going to have to cut your pension checks, which has already happened numerous times.
You were the first on our 12-year broadcast to correctly point out that the typical pension fund, anywhere from Tokyo, where you noted $4 trillion at the time, you know, the key focal financial centers, less than one-half of 1% of the overall funds were invested in precious metals, where the traditional benchmark was 10 to 15%.
Well, that's right, and we've done a lot of number crunching on what the magic number is, and the magic number actually turns out to be 20, because at 20%, you've got a nice balance between volatility and return. If you go over 20%, your volatility increases, but so does your return, and so on. So the best compromise is 20%, and that's really all. Gold's a complicated story when you get into the monetary aspects, but this is quite simple. The issue of 20%. Doesn't matter what the volatility of gold is, when you put it in a portfolio, it reduces the volatility of the portfolio because of the negative correlation. That's the main thing to understand. So if the market corrects and you've got 20%, you'll probably still take a hit, but it'll be a minimal hit compared to not having any gold. But the second thing is that if you're not invested, like let's say right now you just liquefy all your investments and you wait for the market to crash, you imagine the kind of bargains that you can buy? Can you remember the bargains that were at the bottom of 2008? So for the fact that you're not going to be invested for a few months or even a year, you'll have the opportunity of a lifetime to buy your favorite stocks at 50, 60, 70% off. Then you make money. And there's nothing written that you always have to be invested. There's times when you shouldn't be invested.
Aren't we really caught due to this artificially low interest rate environment you've alluded to? Negative 3 to 3.7%. We've never seen that as, by now it's almost a broken record on the show. It's never occurred in financial history. You know, I give you my money and pay you for the courtesy. And so what folks are caught up, I think you'd agree here, they're trying to chase return, any type. You're battling inflation and then you're battling the lack of return. You know, Mr. Nick Barishev has proven here mathematically or statistically that you need this ballast in your keel that will keep your ship afloat, and it's only going to require 20% of your portfolio, and they yawn. And so how can we convince them today that that 20% is a free lunch to protect them, an insurance policy?
That's right, because they, unlike an insurance policy, which is an expense, when you buy gold as a portfolio insurance, it tends to rise in terms of appreciation. So it's basically free insurance that gives you a return. Now, the return isn't in dividends or interest. The return is in capital gain and in purchasing power.
It's a self-perpetuating policy with a return attached. You might think of it as coupons and potential for capital gains. It actually eclipses the value of the typical insurance policy.
That's right. That's the thing. And then, you know, from a capital gain perspective, there's a very simple thing to understand. So last day or so, the World Gold Council announced that gold production is essentially peaked. And the mining industry is only able to kind of replace current mines, but they're not increasing production. And I forget what the numbers are offhand, but it's something like there's 260 trillion of financial assets and something like 150 billion in gold. Sooner or later, part of that 260 trillion of paper assets is going to move to gold. Now, given that the mining industry can't produce any more gold, and a lot of gold is already held in very strong hands, the only adjusting factor is price. And that's when the price goes ballistic.
Well, let's take your number for a moment. We've seen some numbers just thrown around, but let's just assume that the typical gold market is roughly $1 trillion. And you're talking about 220 trillion that might go searching for such a safe haven.
I mean, you just take 5 or 10% of the 220 trillion, the gold price has to go up multiples just for a minuscule increase. The average allocation to gold private hands is less than 1%, and in institutional hands is less than 0.5%. And I'm saying that the optimal number is 20%. It was 20% in the 70s. That's what institutions held. You can run the numbers. It's not a paid or an opinion. You can take any portfolio you want, set up the model, and then include whatever, 5, 10, 15, 20% return, and you'll see the return improves. The volatility goes down, the Sharpe ratio improves, and the Sortino ratio improves. So it's not a question of opinion or being a gold bug. It's just a fact.
It is, and I think it really doesn't it circle us right back to the point that people don't find that fact sexy. But who would own a car, a new car, or a new home without insurance? It's not a sound practice.
And you have like a 10 to 20% allocation, so you have some level of portfolio insurance. I mean, you can do portfolio insurance by doing, you know, puts and so on and so forth, but that's too complicated for the average investor and the average financial advisor. So that's the hedge funds can do that, but just, you know, buy and hold a certain percentage of gold. I've found that gold has generally a negative bias amongst investors and financial advisors. The difference is if I told you that I was going to give you $1 million and you can choose between a stack of $100 bills or a stack, an equivalent amount of gold, and there was only one catch, you couldn't touch it for 20 years. You know what people choose? Gold. I have never run across a single person.
By the way, if that's an offer today, I gladly accept. They're interested in stocks and Bitcoin and all these other bubbly sectors, or maybe in a high yield bond portfolio, a fund or something with 5 or 6% yield. However, if you were to then say you're about to inherit $1 million, how would you allocate those funds? I'll bet you'd find that if you talk them through it, every case they would accept your 20%.
You know, leave a trust fund to your grandkids or something that they're not going to need for 20 years, and you looked at it that way, then, you know, just about everybody says gold, because they know that the purchasing power, whatever the number is, whether it's, you know, 10,000, 100,000, 2,000, doesn't matter, but it'll purchase you the same or more stuff than it can today, and that's the measure of it. It's not what it's worth in dollars, so it's irrelevant. It keeps moving around. It's what it can buy you in the future. And in my book, I have a table there that looked at the price of cars and houses in gold ounces back in the 70s and today, and the Dow in the 70s and the Dow in today. Well, in all cases, you get more stuff for the same number of ounces.
It's so well said. And the other interesting aspect of precious metals, anyone who's ever owned any, after the cash is gone, after the checking account has been emptied, after the brokerage account shows 20 penny stocks, in the final analysis, the precious metals just tend to remain in that safety deposit box or under the floorboards and hidden in the private stockpile. They stand the test of time.
I think that there's going to be some unfortunate, painful lessons learned by many of the people that don't take the time to, you know, explore this with an open mind. If you look into it with an open mind, you'll come to the same conclusion that I have. So
there's such a small fraction of the Western world that own any precious metals. I mean, look at some of the numbers, some of the statistics directly from our government, from the St. Louis Fed and other sources, Labor Department, that indicate something astounding number. Half of Americans live from paycheck to paycheck.
Half Americans don't have $500.
You're exactly right. Because it's easy for people, I think, in this sector who have been involved in the industry for so many decades to forget what it's like to sort of be caught in the system. Because hundreds of millions of people in the U.S., in Europe, in Asia, outside of North America, are caught in a system not necessarily of their making. And we may even intellectually realize it's flawed, but find it difficult to extricate our families.
That's right. So if that's something that people should consider, like I say, to me, you're at this point in time, the risk is too high to be invested, even if you're trying to get a point here and there. But the risk of loss is so, well, when you look at all the equity measures, the Tobin rate, the Tobin indicator, the Buffett indicator, the Shiller ratio, all these things.
Sharp ratio.
You're approaching 1929 levels.
I think they realized the system was literally hours away from unraveling into the abyss.
208 was just a warm-up of what's coming. And they need to do some research and stop listening to the mainstream news and look at any number of the alternative sites and start thinking for themselves. But many people won't do that, so there's nothing you can do about it. You can't convince them.
But let's say that half of Americans have some form of share ownership. I think I remember reading, this may have changed in the last decade, that roughly 150 million Americans had some exposure, most likely through their companies, pensions, programs, and stock ownership plans. But still, they have that feeling, my home price has gone up, and my shares, it's up maybe 100, 200% from 2009. But from a contrarian's perspective, not only is the opportunity cost high here for not owning the precious metals, but as the insurance you referred to, it really represents an incredible value.
Exactly.
Well, as we wrap up here today, sir, care to tell a little bit more about this fascinating $10,000 gold prediction from your magnum opus?
So the book is available on Amazon and Kindle, so it gives people a good basic overview of money and gold and everything works, so I encourage them. That would be a good starting point.
And would you say now that 3 or 4 years after its publishing that you feel the projection might have been overly conservative?
Well, yeah, because the debt has continued to go up.
Thank you, sir. Please return to the show.
Okay, bye now.
With stocks hitting new highs, the next sector to fly could be the precious metals. GoldSeek's top industry analyst just uncovered another solid gold opportunity, Silvercorp Metals. Silvercorp's key property is located in China, the largest gold producer in the world. Silvercorp's net income is soaring, up 589%. Production eclipsed guidance by 27.5%, totaling 6.5 million ounces. Mining operations are literally printing silver at only $3.82 per ounce. AISC net byproducts credits for the fiscal year 2017. Sales increased 51% year over year, and cash flow from operations more than doubled to $80 million. Silvercorp continues to set the industry standard with reduced costs, equity appreciation, a solid dividend, and improved free cash flow. Silvercorp is uniquely positioned to capitalize on rising silver, lead, and zinc prices. To learn more about the exceptional opportunity in Silvercorp Inc., direct your web browser to silvercorpmetals.com, ticker symbol SVM in the U.S. and Canada. Remember to treat your portfolio with a core position in Silvercorp Metals.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Featured guest today says the European Central Bank is at risk of failing, which could send interest rates soaring, outlines contingency plans for investors to shield their portfolios. Martin Armstrong, author of The Greatest Bull Market in History, Economic Confidence Model, and founder of Princeton Economics. Welcome back, Martin Armstrong.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
One of our guests this week noted that we're looking at a bubble in stocks, bonds, real estate, almost everywhere they look.
Well, it's basically capital just trying to get off the grid. I mean, you have to look at it from this perspective. We see what's going on in Catalan, in Barcelona. And the police are now finally starting to stand up to defend their own local people against Madrid. That is what I wrote on the blog. It is, even back in the Ukrainian crisis, if the Ukrainian revolution would work, if the police defended the people against the government. And that's what happened there. So we're starting to see it in Barcelona. But capital is trying to effectively, it doesn't trust banking system, particularly in Europe. It doesn't trust governments. And the interest rates are basically so low that it's just trying to get off the grid. And that's been the real issue. So you've seen real estate reach bubble, you know, peaks in around the world, and London, France, Australia, Vancouver, Miami. And then you have, you know, stock markets up with, you know, people keep calling for this crash for at least, you know, last 7 years in a row, I think. And they just don't understand it. If you have major institutional money, they have to park it someplace. So traditionally, stock market crashes, you go to the bond market. But the bond market is basically negative, and people don't trust the government. So where do you go? That's why we're getting these bubbles. It's capital shifting from public to private.
Obviously, as you say, capital isn't happy with the government. I mean, we see Bitcoin, the cryptos, also benefiting from this theme, you know, away from traditional currencies. We also have the, you know, geopolitical tensions between the West and North Korea, the potential for, you know, thermonuclear war, hydrogen bombs being tested over the Pacific. Do you think the markets have discounted all of this? Is this just a ploy to distract our attention away from the economic troubles we have?
You do have effectively North Korea rising because of the economic problems. And he's a dictator. And dictators, they basically need some sort of an enemy. Even when, you know, when the Iron Curtain fell, the biggest crisis in the United States for the establishment was, well, okay, fine, we need an enemy. Who's it going to be now? I mean, I've been down in Washington and like these Russian sanctions and stuff. And I said, I mean, I don't understand, you know, what you're talking about here. Oh, you interfere with the, you know, Democratic Party. I said, really? I said, there hasn't been one allegation. Let's assume Russia did everything they said, okay? There hasn't been one allegation that any of the information that came out, any of the emails on Hillary, were fake, altered, or a lie. So whoever did the hacking, supposedly, all right, did a great service because they just revealed the truth. There hasn't been anybody that said that they've been fake. You know, when I asked them, and I said, what is it with Russia? They said, well, I said, they're no longer communists, so why are they our enemy? And they really can't answer the question. They said, well, they're Russian. Oh, so, okay. It's really baffling, but North Korea, he needs an enemy, and he doesn't have one. He's effectively the last real communist state standing. He needs to pretend that he's strong. Otherwise, eventually the people are going to rise up against him. Once they see any sign of weakness, he's gone. So he needs to keep this whole thing going, honestly. The biggest danger really is to South Korea or North Korea, or to Japan. But it's because it would be very difficult to shoot down a missile from North Korea to Japan. But, I mean, there wouldn't be a lot of time. You have to wonder if there wouldn't be his right-hand man who's just going along with it because he doesn't want to say no. He's afraid that he would be executed. But you reach that stage where you love your country, perhaps, but what people are not paying attention to is Iran. Iran's now starting. They're going to now develop their missile defense system. They see North Korea getting away with it, and they say, hey, you know, we might as well do the same thing. Just so you're going to have the two of them now.
Moving on to the Fed funds futures, you know, it looks like we've got really solid odds for a rate hike in December, maybe one more in 2018. It really just looks like token hikes here to say, hey, see, we told you we would raise rates. We had the guts to do it. Whereas in reality, it's negligible. It won't have any impact on inflation.
What you have to understand is that there is the crisis we really face. And I've been in meetings on this. There are people who now understand that the dollar being the reserve currency is a problem. And I'm talking about in Washington. Because the Federal Reserve has become de facto the central bank of the world. Now, the problem that presents is it creates a conflict between international policy and domestic. The Fed wanted to raise rates starting back in 2014. The Federal Reserve is the only central bank that even has its head on straight. You've had Yellen constantly coming out saying that we have to normalize interest rates. Why? For two reasons. One, if you're going to use the Keynesian model, we lower interest rates to stimulate the economy. Very nice. But they got to raise them in order to be, you know, to lower them in order to get any stimulation effect for the next crash. The second reason is more important. And that has been effectively that we're looking at the pension fund crisis. And you're starting to see this. I mean, the BBC just put it on, I think, yesterday, that over 3 million people in Britain, you know, have a 50-50 chance of actually getting their pension. Interest rates have been so low that the pension funds are going broke. You have Illinois. People are just trying to leave. You have real estate crashing because nobody wants to move there. And because you have, it went to the Supreme Court, and they said in their constitution they cannot lower the pension funds. So basically you have government employees saying, hey, we don't care, just go tax them more. This is for us. It's destroying the state, absolutely destroying it. But this is systemic. I mean, you have California talking about raising taxes because the pension fund CalPERS isn't making its targets. New Jersey, I mean, everybody was on yelling, you know, about Christie and making jokes about him and everything else. But effectively, you know, what he did when he came in, he said, hey, look, we got a $56 billion deficit here in the pension funds for state employees. You guys have got to give something back. And they said, no, we want more. And it's been a battle with him, you know, ever since. So this is systemic. It's It's all over the place. And that's what Yellen is saying. We have to normalize interest rates. And too far behind on the curve. And without getting interest rates up a lot faster, you're looking at major pension fund defaults. They're all going broke. They need it effectively. The pension fund model, the way they do all forecasting, whatever trend in motion will stay in motion. Okay, so they assumed that they would always be earning 8%. That was very nice, but they haven't been able to do that. So and government is failing for the same reason. As they keep raising taxes, you're getting deflation, not inflation. Why? Because they, at the same time, you're making it too expensive for people to raise a family and get married. The Census Bureau shows that the largest number of 30-year-olds living still with their parents. Japan, they're calling it the celibacy syndrome. They're not even dating. In Britain, they just did an article in the Telegraph how all these girls are in their 20s. They're all looking for men in their 40s. Because basically, if you want to have a family, you know, things have changed. And the code word is we have to normalize interest rates. And basically what that means is if we don't get these things up, we got major problems. And I don't think she can raise them fast enough. So it's basically what you're looking at, raising interest rates not because of inflation, but because taxes are basically sucking any excess disposable income out of people. But it's just trying to rebalance the system. And, you know, it's not working. So the Fed has become the central bank of the world. And you have the IMF and everybody lobbying against them. Oh, please don't raise interest rates. You'll hurt our economies. But then the stock market goes up. And as the stock market goes up, the Fed has to testify before Congress. And the Democrats say, oh, see, you're just helping the rich get richer. So they're caught between a rock and a hard place.
Moving on to the U.S. equities market, you know, I think you made a great point earlier in the discussion. Every pundit of the last 8 or so years has been falsely calling a top on this stock market rally. The momentum's on your side. Why fight it?
Largely because they just use traditional analysis and they are not looking at the whole picture. Honestly, you cannot forecast any market in isolation. You just can't. You have to understand this is a global economy. I mean, I can give you a very good example. The 1987 crash, when I got called into the Brady Commission, initially going to start with the same proposition. Oh, we're going to find that sure player to push the market down. And I basically said, okay, fine. You know, we realize every investigation since 1907 has all sought this mythical great white whale that shorted the market and forced it down. You know, and you never found anybody. And they're just looking at me. I said, you understand even how markets function? And they said, yeah, well, you know, I just borrow stock from this person and I sell it to that person. I said, okay, fine. So there's two longs, not one. And I said, so how is this mythical short player always going to outnumber the longs? And they're just looking at me like, I said, let's talk about futures. Every contract has to be matched. And they're just like, well, what makes it go down? I said, very simple. Everybody's long. Something happens, some sort of news, whatever it is, that scares them. They turn to sell, and there's no bid. Have you ever traded markets? You know, and that's what a flash crash is. The danger is no bid. And so you have Europe, for example. They've made it against the law to short government bonds, desperately trying to keep everything up. So there is no market. They've destroyed the free markets in Europe. I mean, you have this Catalonia thing going on, and normally you would expect the Spanish bonds to be down. I've advised my clients, listen, anybody that has any Spanish bonds, the ECB has a permanent floor here. They're buying everything to make it look as if there isn't a panic. Sell it to them and say thank you very much. And they will own 100% of the Spanish debt. They already own something like over 50%. Markets, you know, do you need the short player? Because he's the only one that has the courage to buy in a panic. But, you know, this is the problem. People don't understand how markets actually function. When, I mean, Barron's came out, I mean, well, we said, all right, fine. the market's going to rally and make new highs. We gave that forecast back in 2010. A lot of people, you know, that don't know us, they think, oh, that's crazy. But the model's been, every time it's called that, it has always been right. And Barron's wrote a piece on it in 2011. And it was almost like a tongue-in-cheek thing, I think, because they didn't call me to interview me. They said, oh, Armstrong's saying the market's going to make a new high. Like, ha, ha, ha. Of course, they never printed anything after that. But, I mean, if you look at the P.E. ratio, you get these people saying, oh, 25 P.E., oh, the market's going to crash. The high on the P.E. ratio for a trading thing was basically the dot-com bubble, and it was 50. But what is the historical high? The historical high is 120. When? At the bottom, 2009. Why? If you're worried about the government's going bust, you're worried about the banks, you don't can't trust the banks, where do you put your money? They said, thank you very much. I'll buy IBM. I'll buy the blue chips. You get to a point where it's not how much money am I going to make? What's the return? What's the dividends? Forget all that stuff. It's like I just want to park my money so I get it back. Interest rates went negative.
Martin, when that trend turns around, where do those funds flow then?
Look, you have two sides to the coin. And this is why I've been telling people about this, you know, what our economic conference model is all about. It's public versus private. You get, you know, one wave, okay, fine. It's the private sector that's excessive and that crashes. That's like 1929. Then, all right, what happens? Confidence then runs away from the public into the public sector. So then you go into, and that wave peaked in 1981. That's the way we grew up in, and, you know, oh, government bonds, they're always the best thing, AAA, et cetera. Now we're back to a private wave. And this private wave, you're seeing people confusing, the stock market keeps going up, bond markets going down or being rigged, because capital is running away from the public sector. Then the public, you know, the private sector gets excessive, it goes bust, and then it runs back the other way again. I mean, it's back and forth throughout history.
I'm sure you saw what happened in Puerto Rico. I know you probably still have property in Florida like many of our listeners. You saw Irma, you know, you saw Jose, and we've all seen Harvey, one of the roughest hurricane seasons, even eclipsing Katrina. But almost 4 million people there without power, 3.4 million, and they're talking 4 to 6 months without power. Hundreds, if not thousands, could die from disease, hunger, job losses. 7,000 people right now still in the shelters because there's nowhere to go. Puerto Rico, it's not a state. It's a province of the U.S. What does this mean for us? What does it mean from a humanitarian perspective?
You basically have to understand that those, particularly the islands, you know, and you saw the pictures of basically look like a war zone. They're built out of wood sticks. They're frame houses. They're not going to withstand even a hurricane level 3. You come to Florida, you can't, it's against the law to build a house like that. The place I'm in, the windows are rated to 200 miles an hour. You have to have that. They have to be, you know, impact. The house is all block or concrete. I mean, it's not going anywhere. I mean, mobile homes, yes, they're going to be picked up and tossed away, and that's going to be if it's in the Midwest in a tornado. Being out, you know, without power, honestly, you know, they should use the opportunity right now to put all your power lines underground. I mean, I understand this. We're still, you know, living like it's the 1920s. Those areas, either they start, if they're going to rebuild houses, do it out of block, not, you know, wood frames. As simple as that. I mean, you have to, you are in a hurricane alley down there, and you have to understand that. I mean, I moved out by Tampa because cyclically this area is not necessarily in zone zero for hurricanes. That they tend to hit the East Coast more. But I mean, I lived up in New Jersey and we had, you know, hurricanes that went all the way up there. I had an uncle who had a house on the beach in New Jersey. He lost it to one in the 1950s, and then he built it again, and he lost it, and he gave up after that.
Yeah, I didn't know that you were in the Tampa area. You know, St. Petersburg, your sister city there, has a museum. We recently visited St. Petersburg. Great beaches. The Dali Museum, you know, Salvador Dali, surrealist art. We've got India's festivities. They start up around this time of the year. Jewelers are usually happy. Big demand stemming from approximately 1 billion folks there in India and outside the country. We've had some solid advances in the precious metals on a crushing defeat for the U.S. dollar, which has just plunged to lows through every support level that it's had over the last several years. Do you have any positive comments for our precious metals aficionados?
The decline in the dollar, we've called this basically, we call this the year from political hell. And you have to understand what's been going on. It started with Brit exit. Then Trump was elected. You've had, of course, this right going on right now in Barcelona. But Merkel has been basically the foundation of the euro. She's the one that has been pushing the austerity, et cetera, on everybody, and has harmed actually the European economy more than anybody. But, you know, she lost 9%. She's down to 32.5. I mean, nobody in the United States would ever even get into office with such a rating. But they have a coalition-type government. So they're trying to, you know, to form a government there, and so she remains. But it's debatable how long she's going to be able to hold on. I mean, the AfD won a sizable chunk, which is the first time that they're going to get a seat, and it's all over the refugee issue. And we're looking at largely a change in trend for the dollar and basically going back up, but it should have been declining going through this election process. Everybody hoping that, you know, with Merkel's going to win and everything, but she lost substantially. And if you pick up the rug and look carefully, what's the overall trend? And that is that all these various left-wing socialist parties are losing dramatically. The SPD, which was usually the, you know, partnering with Merkel's CDU, is now seeing itself, well, maybe we're going to have to be in the opposition. They fell to 20%, the lowest, you know, that they have ever had. If, you know, you can go to our site and you'll see, we plotted the Democrats and the Republicans, the House and Senate combined as a percentage of total seats. You'll see that the Democrats peaked with the first election of FDR. That was it. They've been making lower highs and lower lows ever since. We're just at a point where government is just too big. It's consuming way too much. And this whole idea of raising the quantity of money is going to be inflationary, that assumes an awful lot. It assumes that money's actually going to the people in the streets and they're going to be spending it. First of all, it only went to the bankers. And then what did the bankers do? They said, okay, fine, but we don't want to lend it to we want to put it back with government. So then the Fed created excess reserves. So fine, it created $4 trillion. Everybody said, oh, that's going to be hyperinflationary. No. Why? Because the banks then put $3 trillion back in excess reserves on deposit at the Fed, collecting 0.5%. China used it and said, oh, gee, thanks a lot. You want to buy in all these 30-year bonds? And they sold them. China's down now, you know, keeping an average maturity of 5 years or less. So the money never went anywhere. You look at what's going on in Europe. You've had almost 10 years of quantitative easing. You get deflation. Okay, fine, the ECB stimulating the economy. No, it didn't. It now owns 40% of the government debt. It didn't help the private sector at all. You have the European governments basically on life support, but that's it. So, I mean, if you want to actually stimulate the economy, how about giving the money to the people? You know, not to government and banks. But, you know, they haven't gotten, you know, they haven't learned that lesson yet. Gold is going to take off, but, you know, you have to realize it's not, you know, not everybody thinks like you. Okay, and the older generation, you know, all right, a gold coin is a gold coin. Go to Starbucks. You'll see the young kids in there, they just hold up their phone. They don't even have paper money. They're perfectly willing to accept the fact that electronic money, yes, what's the problem with that? So things aren't changing. You look in India And, you know, they're talking over there about the youth don't buy the gold. You know, the same thing here. I mean, you have, you know, the youth are tending to rent rather than buy houses. Why? Because they saw their parents. Oh, yeah, they put all their money into it. You have to understand that they are, okay, an institution, a pension fund or something like that. They can't go in and start buying a bunch of gold. And one, it costs to store it, and two, it doesn't produce an income. The institutions aren't the buyers. What I'm saying is that what made gold go up in the 70s? All right, it's when basically people were inundated by inflation, but they saw it coming from OPEC. Okay, everything was plastic was going up. As they began to see everything rise in price, I mean, I lived through it. I remember people were hoarding toilet paper. All right, everything was going up. So it was a crash in the confidence of, you know, that's going to cost me more if I wait to buy next month than this month. We saw the same thing in Japan. Japan was going to put in a retail sales tax. The month before, everybody ran out, bought whatever they intended to buy. Why? Because they knew it was going to cost them more. And you looked at the economic statistics of Japan. Oh, you know, the economy's finally reversed. Yeah, it was for 1 month. And then it went right back down. So people aren't stupid. The same thing with real estate and interest rates. And they keep lowering interest rates and trying to stimulate. It doesn't work. As soon as the interest rates go up, what happens? Then people know it's going to cost them more to buy a house next month than this month. They run out and they buy. As long as it keeps going down, they wait. They're not stupid. All right, and it's just the people that think that they can manipulate the society. So gold is going to take off, but what you're really missing yet is when you get to that point where the person on the street starts looking at this and saying, you know, I don't really know what's going on, and I don't really trust the governments anymore. And that's when you're going to see it move. But the crack in the monetary system, and that a number of people say, oh, the fiat system, etc., they don't quite understand. And I get a lot of questions, oh, China's going to displace the dollar. Not yet. Yes, it will, but not after it's about 2032. If you're a major institution, all right, you got $10 billion to invest, are you going to buy Chinese government bonds or U.S. government bonds? Until that answer is China, it's not going to happen. The number one thing that's going to break the entire world monetary system is the dollar going up, not down. If it goes down, everybody's fat and happy. Because emerging markets, everybody borrows in dollars. If the dollar goes up, that's when you start getting the sovereign defaults. Emerging markets go down. You have pension funds bought their debt because they were getting a higher yield. They suddenly get defaulted on. That's what breaks everything. Then you're going to see a monetary system change. That's when gold's going to take off, etc. You need that shake in confidence. And when that happens, I mean, you'll see the stock market rise and you'll see gold rise together, not in opposition. You look at going into from 76 to 1980, yeah, gold went up, so did the stock market.
You see something similar this time around?
Yeah, I mean, the system is being pushed to its limits, all right? The fact that Merkel didn't lost so substantial a chunk in Germany is very important. Yeah, I mean, you look at the, you know, euro has been tanking ever since. It's an undermining of the confidence. Once you undermine the confidence of what's going on in Europe, what happens? The capital comes here that pushes the dollar up. The U.S. was bankrupt in 1896. That's when J.P. Morgan had to lend $100 million gold to the Treasury to bail it out and all that kind of stuff. What made the United States what we are? World War I and World War II. We were the arms dealer and the breadbasket. All right, while Europe was running around blowing itself up, we're the ones that supplied the food, and we're the ones that supplied the guns. You look at it, by 1950, the U.S. had 76% of the entire world gold reserves. They all came here. So that's what you're looking for. When the confidence cracks in Japan, maybe because of North Korea, whatever, the smart money leaves. They only have one place to go, and that's the USA. That's it.
Now, there is an alternative. In a recent Zero Hedge article, the ECB admits they are powerless to stop Bitcoin. They have no control over cryptocurrencies. Of course, the Bank of Japan also noted recently, I think this week, that their J-coin will trade in tandem with the yen by the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo. Japan's 70% cash economy, that exceeds most developed nations, the largest percentage share of the Bitcoin market. You would think it's China, but actually they are just barely the largest Japan. Give us your thoughts on the cryptos and the implications for the real markets.
I mean, it's coming. Eventually, we're moving towards that sort of system. What I don't think will happen is Bitcoin will survive or something like that. And the way government goes after it is just simply passing a law. The U.S. is putting in a law that if you have more than $10,000 in a cryptocurrency when you're returning to the to the country from overseas, you have to declare it. As if you've got $10,000 in your cash pocket. You don't have to do that for a bank account, but you do for electronic currencies. You have to realize is that government has the guns and the tanks. They're not really going to tolerate some sort of a currency that's in competition with them. You do have the central banks in negotiations right now to create a electronic currency. You have China looking at doing the same thing. So they're going to be electronic currencies. There's no question about that. But derivative contracts are being traded, hedged. I mean, that's where the big money really is. And effectively, that's not really paper dollars either. It's just all electronic entries. That's the longer term. Individuals, yeah, sure, you can buy some Bitcoin, put your money in there. But look at Bitcoin. It goes up and down like crazy. Bet on any stock and call that a store of wealth, too. So it's more like, where do I put my money that I know I'm going to get it back?
That sounds like gold and silver. Where do you park your cash? Where do you park your wealth and sleep at night?
For individuals that they can certainly have some gold and you can't keep it in the bank anymore.
But what do you say about, like the StreetTrax ETF, the GLD, the SLV, and even the Central Fund of Canada, ticker CEF? The big institutions, they can purchase shares. There are options contracts on all of these precious metals trading vehicles. And that would seem to give them some exposure, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they can trade. Sure, they get involved in gold stocks, et cetera. What I'm saying is that what they don't do is physically take the metal and park it in some warehouse for them.
How many years away do you think we are from that moment, cross the threshold where people realize, wait a minute, this, as you say, is a systemic mess in the financial system?
I would say from probably about 2024 on, but it's going to start effectively next year in 18. If stocks top and crash, so will gold. The two of them will go up together. Because what happens is everything becomes, some people will prefer stocks, some people prefer gold, some people prefer art, some people prefer, ancient coins. But everything tangible that is movable becomes a hedge against the government. That's what makes the transition to whatever new currency you have. But the biggest risk is probably the unmovable tangible assets, such as real estate. And because what that is so dependent upon is leverage, mortgages. If the banking system goes and you can't get a mortgage, then you're going to see housing go back down to where it was in the 30s. I mean, that's why FDR created all the various different, systems to, from FDIC and Fannie Mae, et cetera. They were all created at that point to leverage things because real estate had fallen to the point that it was 5 cents to 10 cents on the dollar from 1850 levels. If nobody's willing to lend you money, real estate goes for cash. Whoever has the cash, I only got 5,000. Okay, fine, I'll take the 5. That's where you get more of a crash. So you'd see more of a crash in real estate than you would in a stock market.
Let's say we've had a caller here who's just inherited $100,000, wants to have some spectacular gains. We create a portfolio for them, 25% in cryptos, 25% silver, 25% high PE stocks. Improve on that portfolio for our listener.
Well, I would basically be very careful with the cryptos because, you know, you can have a government simply issue a law at any point in time. And it's just writing a pen. That's it. And that's the biggest problem. So it's a huge just change in definition. So I would be careful with the cryptocurrencies, the side of looking at equities, increasing that, because I think you're going to be looking at the equity side moving up much better. The major resistance is basically the 23,000 level in the Dow. Once you get past that area, then you'll probably see a fairly aggressive rise up to the 2025, that 2025 area, before it would encounter another plateau of resistance again. But watch the currencies on a global scale and the capital flows. I mean, the more trouble happens in Europe, the more the money's going to come in this direction. Number one place it's going is in the equity side. I would, you know, pay attention and understand what the equities do. As long as the Dow leads, that shows the big money and international money. When the Dow starts to lag and becomes the last one to go up, that's the time to get out. All right? The S&P is more of the general market. You have domestic institutions involved, and then you have NASDAQ. NASDAQ is the retail speculative one. All right, it's the one that gets a little bit wilder, but the major institutions don't participate. You know, those are the three indexes, and they each reflect the interests of different ones. You know, as far as the precious metals are concerned, yes, they're going to go up, but we have to get through. We have one more election coming up, and that's going to be, you know, Italy. And if Italy also turns basically against the EU, you're looking at a serious crack in the euro. And that can send the dollar up dramatically, which will be defeat what Trump wants to create. And then you'll start seeing, as the dollar goes up, calls for protectionism, the same thing as in the Great Depression. And then that will force the change. When the dollar went up, that is why FDR confiscated money, confiscated the gold in 34 and devalued the dollar. When the dollar went up into 1985, again, making all record highs, what did they do? They formed G5 to manipulate the dollar down. As long as the dollar goes down, they're fat and happy. They could care less. They're going to get more jobs domestically, export more stuff, and they're everybody's happy. Dollar goes up, watch how things in Washington change.
What is your top story for 2018? If you had to forecast next year, what do you think will startle investors? What do you see on the horizon?
2018 is the beginning on our models for the monetary crisis cycle. So dollar being pushed up, you're going to see much more headlines of pension funds going into default, and you're going to see a lot more problems starting to emerge in Europe. I mean, I know people are always, you know, bashing the dollar, et cetera, and all the U.S. national debt. All right, fine, at $20 trillion. The world debt, all right, on the sovereign level is $160 trillion. We're nothing in comparison to everything else. Then you take Europe. The ECB is in danger of actually watching a central bank collapse. Yeah, the Federal Reserve bought some treasuries, said it's going to sell them back out, it's not buying anymore. $3 trillion on 20. The ECB owns 40% of the government debt. 40%. They are scared to death what's going to happen when the ECB stops buying. Will they be your buyer? You're looking at major defaults in Europe. The central bank is in danger of actually defaulting. It is. You know, this is why Draghi is scared to death. They're trying to create a euro bond. Germany's against it. Why? Because they're always afraid of inflation. So the proposition is to create a euro derivative bond, a CDO, all right? The same thing that blew up in 2007. This is their solution for out of the problem. They want to put everybody's debt together in a CDO and say, see, you know, it would just be this, so it won't actually be absorbing the debt of Greece or Spain. And they're trying to sell that to the Germans. They're trying to create some sort of a central market to buy European debt that is illegal to short. They're trying to create a buyer for when the ECB stops buying the government debt. They're on life support. I'm telling you, it's so bad you wouldn't believe it. And then you take the European banking system. The way they present it, it's all propaganda. You have Paribas taking over Commerce Bank. And it's being portrayed, oh, this is fantastic. This is showing a German-French alliance. No, Commerce Bank is broke. All right, it's merging something that's failing. But the spin the press puts on, oh, this is going to be great for Europe. No, it's not. Paribas is 10 times the size of a Commerce Bank, and its banks are every bank over there. What did it do? Its reserves, they had to be politically correct. So they had to have a piece of everybody's debt because there is no central debt. In the U.S., our banks are much stronger. The only thing they have for reserves is federal debt. That's it. They can't buy debt from Mississippi. Over there, they had Greece, they have Spain, they have Italy, and all these countries you hear about getting in trouble. Well, guess what? When they say, oh, very fine, we're going to give a haircut to Greek debt. You're cutting the reserves of the bank. You have the European banking system is, I'm telling you, a stiff wind will blow it over. There's been rumors going on about Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank's the biggest bank, and it's in trouble.
Final question. The forecaster, we're looking for this potential follow-up. Any news on the next movie?
Actually, I'm supposed to talk to them on Saturday. I've been over in Abu Dhabi this week. Now, all I know is that it is in the hands of directors, and it has been reviewed. I don't know, there's some company that reviews scripts or whatever, and they think it's quite astonishing. And so there are a number of directors looking at it, who they end up selecting to go through it. I mean, I was told, 2 weeks ago, even Oliver Stone was looking at it now, particularly because of the connection with how Putin came into power and everything. So they're doing that, and I think there's also going to be a sequel to the forecaster on the documentary side.
We'll definitely be looking forward to that and more information from Princeton Economics. Care to share any contact information?
Really interested, then just go to our main site, which is armstrongeconomics.com. You won't find ads or anything else, or you have to click on things just to get to read something. We don't take advertising, and you don't have to register to look at it. So we're trying to keep it as a public service for the world, and that's our main goal, so that people understand what's really happening. I mean, if our biggest danger is when things go bust in the middle of the night, which way do we go? Do we go towards freedom or do we go towards authoritarianism? And that's my greatest concern. The more people we can educate that the problem is government and that's where we have to be careful with, then maybe we can stand up and survive and move in the right direction for once. But just look at Catalonia. I mean, Madrid sent in 16,500 troops to shut down elections on Sunday.
No, it's serious. I mean, Venezuela as well is an absolute disaster right now. All right, well, Martin Armstrong, we appreciate your thoughts, and we look forward to hearing more of them in 2018.
Thank you for inviting me.
With stocks hitting new highs, the next sector to fly could be the precious metals. GoldSeek's top industry analyst just uncovered another solid gold opportunity, Silvercorp Metals. Silvercorp's key property is located in China, the largest gold producer in the world. Silvercorp's net income is soaring, up 589%. Production eclipsed guidance by 27.5%, totaling 6.5 million ounces. mining operations are literally printing silver at only $3.82 per ounce. AISC net byproducts credits for the fiscal year 2017. Sales increased 51% year over year, and cash flow from operations more than doubled to $80 million. Silvercorp continues to set the industry standard with reduced costs, equity appreciation, a solid dividend, and improved free cash flow. Silvercorp is uniquely positioned to capitalize on rising silver, lead, and zinc prices. To learn more about the exceptional opportunity in Silvercorp, Inc., direct your web browser to silvercorpmetals.com, ticker symbol SVM in the U.S. and Canada. Remember to treat your portfolio with a core position in Silvercorp Metals.
Gold Seek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. Significant energies have been directed toward the NFL and the American flag this week, diverting attention from other important issues. Eventually, as commentators and the public work through the real meaning and symbolism of the flag narrative, at its root, I believe we will find a discourse on the present and future role of sovereignty, both for the country and for the individual that the country itself was built upon. Sovereignty is under attack, and with it, everything attributable to that sovereignty is also under attack and is attempting to be renegotiated. But it appears not from a place of principle or reason, but rather from a place of disorganized emotion. It's never enough to be against something. That's easy. Anyone can be against anything. What matters is what you stand for. It's like criticizing someone about something without offering or suggesting a different course of action that could lead to a different result. Criticism by itself is often counterproductive and divisive. And unless that is your goal, constructive criticism is supposed to come with thoughtful suggestions attached to align and redirect a conversation toward potentially better solution-based outcomes. We'll see if that actually happens, and if mainstream media can begin the process of rebuilding its self-inflicted, fake news, tarnished credibility. Last week, I suggested that healthcare will once again be the silent agent of change in the ongoing reformation of the U.S. political landscape. Inaction and an unspoken alliance of political swamp creatures, both seen and unseen, who are still seething mad and passive-aggressive toward political change, are and will continue to be obstructionists for change. But the question is, how long will people tolerate that kind of inaction? Despite the president endorsing one candidate in an Alabama Senate primary, a second candidate actually won, signaling that the public's appetite for change may not be completely dependent on the personality of the current occupant of the White House. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell once again placed healthcare reform on hold because even with a majority in the Senate, he cannot, or rather will not, rally his team. Several senators who like to hear their names in the news on a regular basis whose egos I will not satisfy by uttering their names here, will, I believe, all pay a very heavy price politically. Senator Bob Corker in Tennessee surprisingly announced that he will not seek re-election when Steve Bannon announced he will be running a primary candidate against Corker in 2018. You will begin to see many who are up for re-election decide for a variety of reasons not to run for re-election. Not because they are afraid of Steve Bannon and the arsenal of candidates he will no doubt position in key states, but because they are afraid of the wrath of the U.S. voter and the economic instability they have knowingly ratcheted up, because they would rather be against a president who beat them all than support the citizens who put him there. Remember, it's not enough to be against someone or something. You have to know what it is you stand for. I believe many on both sides of the aisle who have fooled us into thinking they stand for us will be found out to stand for nothing more than themselves. And rather than face humiliation and angry voters, they will quickly exit the theater. We can only hope. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.